This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today will focus on the risk of preterm labor. Can it be predicted? Can it be prevented? My guest is a returning person, a wonderful physician who we were able to interview some years ago, Dr. Valerie Whiteman, perinatologist at Temple University Hospital, medical director of outpatient obstetrics at Temple Women's Health Center of Temple University Hospital, and director of obstetrics outpatient services at Temple Hospital. You have a full plate. Welcome back, Dr. Whiteman.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's good to have you back. What is the normal time frame of gestation before a normal delivery takes place?
Well, a normal pregnancy is supposed to last between 38 to 40 plus weeks. When we give a due date, we give you a window of 2 weeks, either before or after, where it's considered okay to deliver the baby. Before 38 weeks is considered preterm or early.
How do you actually compile that date frame? Is it based on the last cycle?
Pregnancy is dated by the last cycle, and if a woman has had an ultrasound earlier in the pregnancy to confirm when her due date is, that would provide us with a reasonable idea in terms of how far along in the pregnancy she is and when she's due.
So outside of that range, what would make it a risk? At what point do you think it would come into, or do you know that it would come into a risky pregnancy?
Well, nature has made it pretty much that a pregnancy delivered after 38 weeks, all other things being considered equal, that a baby born after 38 weeks in a pregnancy will do okay, will actually be able to function and survive and thrive on the outside. Unfortunately, a lot of patients don't get to 38 weeks. The earlier in a pregnancy that a woman delivers the baby, the more chances that the baby is going to have for having difficulties. And it's really a matter of things just not quite being ready yet, or as I sometimes put it when I'm with my patients, the pop-up timer isn't up on the chicken. It's just not ready.
I love it. It's in the oven, but not ready to come out.
Not ready to come out.
But if it's risky, how can you get to know this? How can you anticipate that is not going to be the full term?
Well, unfortunately, there is no hard, in fact, way to know which patient's going to deliver early. I might be showing my age here, but thinking back to the Tonight Show when a certain character would put the envelope to his head to try to predict, you know, what was going on.
And Johnny Carson.
I'm admitting that I remember those days. We can't predict just by looking at a patient which woman is going to deliver early or which one's going to deliver on time. And we unfortunately may have to wait until either things happen and she starts having contractions or use some of her historical factors. The best historical factor being if she's delivered early before. But in terms of predicting which woman would deliver early, we don't have any real way to predict that on someone who's not contracting. For some woman who comes in the office from the street and is perfectly fine, there are very few ways that we can test. One thing that we can offer is a test looking at the cervix with the ultrasound, measuring out how long the cervix is. And that can give us a reasonable idea in terms of how risky she is for delivering early. Another thing that we can offer is actually doing a swab of some of the fluid that's in the vagina in the birth canal, and that can give us a clue if she's not going to deliver early. But in terms of having a real hard and fast test to be able to determine which woman's going to deliver early or not, unfortunately, with all the advances in medicine, we haven't gotten there yet.
Are there some tests on the way at this point that might suggest they are going in that direction?
Well, there are a few tests that are on the way. One of the projects that I'm working on is actually looking to determine if a very small device can actually predict which woman is going to deliver early. This is basically taking advantage of the fact that we know that a normal cervix, which is the mouth of the womb, is normally very firm throughout pregnancy, is normally very firm when a woman isn't pregnant. As someone gets closer to labor and gets closer to the time for contractions, that starts to soften. It starts to undergo its own changes. And this is a test that will look to see whether or not a woman is actually having some of those changes in terms of cervical softening using a very small device.
What's that called?
It's actually called a bioprobe. It's been used in other fields of medicine. It's been used to determine when someone ovulates or is about to express an egg for a pregnancy to occur. But now we're looking at this in more ways in women's health. And Temple right now is the only place that's using this device for the purpose of predicting preterm labor or to see if it's even possible to use it for this.
When you have that kind of testing, is it a long time to determine whether it's actually accurate compared with other kinds of methods?
Well, keep in mind, this is still very much in the very early phases, so we don't have an answer for that question as of yet. So I guess we'll be seeing each other again after I finish with this. But theoretically, it can be used at the bedside. And optimally, if we get the kind of results that I anticipate that we'll get, this could be something that could be used at the bedside or even in the office with the results available right away.
If it's a probe, is that dangerous to insert a probe?
Actually, it's much smaller than the size of an average tampon. It's very small.
So that's not a major thing. There's still the same problems until then, until that's perfected, of trying to decide how to work with patients who might be subject to preterm.
Yes, but there still are issues in terms of determining which ones are subject to preterm labor.
What kinds of other risks do patients have which might either contribute to preterm or to a risky pregnancy? Perinatologists are into the risk characteristics, are they not?
Yes, I jokingly call my job going where no person would boldly go, because we only take care of pregnancies where there's an issue. In terms of other risk factors for delivering preterm, most of the women who are exposed to DES, which was a drug given back in the 60s to continue a pregnancy longer, most of those are now beyond the childbearing age or at the end of their childbearing ages. So we don't have to deal with that very often. One thing that we're seeing more of are patients who've had any kind of procedure done on their cervix, not a pap smear, but patients who've undergone a larger biopsy of their cervix, which could put them at risk for delivering early because a piece of tissue is actually missing. Other risk factors, there is always the big question mark, what we call idiopathic, which means we have no clue why it happens. And unfortunately, most of the patients with preterm labor fall into that category.
Now, in the tests that are being done, and I know this is not your area specifically, but in some of those tests where any samples may be taken in the vaginal area, there are some tests that women go through. Are they part of that grouping that would possibly be suspect when it comes to determining the dangers?
Well, just a very simple biopsy like one done in the office, that would not put a woman at risk. But some of the surgical biopsies, some of the bigger ones, could take a large chunk of cervix out. Some of those patients are coming back in pregnant. And because the mouth of their uterus is so small, the mouth of the womb being shortened, they're at risk for complications further on down the road.
Well, let's just talk about at-risk patients then coming in, and the people and the patients that you deal with in your area. Is it geographically an area where you have people who are more prone to risky pregnancies, which may ultimately end up with a preterm?
Keep in mind, Temple is a tertiary center, so that means we get all the patients referred to us from other outside areas that have any kind of issue. So our experience is very slanted.
What does that mean? I didn't know that.
We get patients referred to us that have any issues that either because the hospital is a wonderful hospital, but they just don't have the capacity to manage a baby that might be born earlier, come to us because our nursery is capable of handling some of the small babies that are a pound or so at the time of birth.
From other parts of the city or the larger region?
Throughout parts of the city, as well as a few that are just outside the boundary of the city. We get patients from out there as well.
So even that as such, you're seeing a at-risk population then?
Yes, we are.
Yeah. And generally speaking, what do you see as the problems that perhaps contribute to these risks?
Oh, the list of problems that contribute to this is probably longer than my arm span, but there are multiple problems that are associated with a risky pregnancy, not just a preterm pregnancy, but a risky pregnancy. I like to say that women serve multiple roles in the society, and only one of those roles is childbirth. If our health when we're not pregnant is not optimized, if we haven't gone to a doctor for diabetes care, for hypertension, which of course is rampant within the African-American community and really rampant throughout society in general, when that woman does become pregnant, we're subject to a whole list of risks for her as well as for the baby. Therefore, if any woman has any kind of pre-existing condition, if she has diabetes, if she has high blood pressure, if she has any other types of diseases before pregnancy, is really to her benefit as well as the benefit of the pregnancy for her to make sure that she has been controlled before she conceives.
Let's take diabetes, for example.
Okay.
This is something that's kind of extensive around the country, and we hear a lot about it. Talk a little bit about how this would really impact on a person, and then in terms of that person becoming a mother.
Diabetes, of course, is one of those silent diseases that people don't realize they have it until it's much further on, unless, of course, they've been under medical supervision. Because of the fact that it's one of those relatively silent diseases, somebody can have diabetes for 2 or 3 years and not even realize it. the underlying effects of diabetes for a long time are starting to take effect, and she may not even know it. One of the things that can happen with uncontrolled diabetes is damage to the blood vessels. If the blood vessels ever get damaged, there's really no way to turn that back. So that's one of those things that once it starts up, once the kidney disease, once the eye disease starts up, we can't turn that back. We can manage to treat it, we can manage to control it and prevent it from getting worse, but we can't turn the clock back. And if those blood vessels are affected, really all the blood vessels in the body can be affected, including the blood vessels that feed the uterus or the womb. So if that patient gets pregnant, she's at significant risk for what we call intrauterine growth restriction, where the baby may not grow properly.
Say that again?
Intrauterine growth restriction, mm-hmm. which means the baby just doesn't grow properly because of the vascular problem. But even more so than that, if a woman's diabetes is not under good control at the time that she conceives, there are significant risks for the baby, regardless of the point in the pregnancy where the baby's delivered. We know that if mom has very poorly controlled diabetes and there's a lot of glucose on her hemoglobin, a lot of glucose on the chemical that's within the red blood cells that holds the oxygen, those patients are a significant risk for the baby to have malformations. The major malformations that we're talking about are the central nervous system malformations, what people know as spina bifida or the, you know, open neural tube type defects. Some of them can be fixed, but it's certainly a major risk for the baby after it's born. And a lot of that can be prevented if we just took better care of someone who had diabetes before she even considered being pregnant.
The spina bifida. Explain a little bit more about what that would be.
What that basically is that there's a defect that forms along the baby's back. Mm-hmm. And some of the nerves are exposed along the course of that defect. Regardless of a point in the pregnancy where that woman delivers the baby, that is something that's extremely serious. You can imagine if the nerves are exposed and as this baby grows and if it's not repaired, or even if it is repaired, there's risk for nerve injury. That can happen more so in women who have diabetes before the pregnancy and their sugar just is not under good control.
So it would be important for a woman who knows she has diabetes to do something about that before she actually goes into conception.
Absolutely. And what we recommend actually for women who are thinking of childbearing or thinking of getting pregnant is to come in for what we call a preconception visit or a pre-pregnancy visit, to come in and actually get seen.
Some people think of this as only being peculiar to heavy women or women because of the weight factor in it, but this is not so, is it?
No, not at all.
So you're seeing women who are slender and all the rest of that?
I've seen women who are every size, shape, and whatever that we can imagine, and it mm-hmm. still is, can affect them.
Mm-hmm. Diabetes is one, and assuming that they go through treatment controls of the diabetes, would that affect breastfeeding?
No, that wouldn't actually affect the breastfeeding at all.
Okay. So that's a plus for a woman to go ahead and not say, well, I wouldn't be able to because.
No, yeah. But that's not a reason or an excuse not to breastfeed.
Okay. You're listening to University Forum. My guest, Dr. Valerie Whiteman, a perinatologist at Temple University Hospital. As we talk about other kinds of problems, diabetes is one, but you also mentioned high blood pressure. What about that? How does that affect the health of the mother and of the infant?
That is one of the major things that affects both the outcome for mom as well as the baby. Hypertension is still, despite all of the advances in medicine, one of the major reasons for pregnancy to be lost, and actually even for a mother to succumb during the pregnancy. Hypertension affects, again, every blood vessel in the body, not just, you know, when we check someone's blood pressure in the office, it affects every blood vessel in the body. If someone's blood pressure is not controlled before the pregnancy, it's possible that she can actually have what we call preeclampsia, what was known in our mother's days as toxemia of pregnancy, where your blood pressure would go sky high, potentially actually even kill the baby if the blood pressure is not well controlled. And one of the issues that can occur with toxemia or preeclampsia is that mom can actually have a seizure. It certainly is associated with significant risk for mom as well as the baby. The best thing to do is to keep the blood pressure controlled. But we need to know that you have high blood pressure before you get pregnant to be able to optimize the control.
Which suggests a whole lot of need for pre-pregnancy care. How do you handle that in your operation? Because you really get them at the other end. I see that you've done lectures and all kinds of things of that sort. What do you suggest there?
Oh, I've been very vocal about a number of women's health issues, but one thing I always advocate for is for patients, for anyone, to go to a doctor even for your annual checkup, don't wait until there's a problem. Don't wait until you're pregnant to see a doctor. Because by the time you come in and there's a problem, you come in with the headache, you come in and you're pregnant and you see that there's an issue, it's already almost too late in many circumstances. We haven't had the opportunity to take full advantage of the advances that have occurred in medical care.
Well, you've done quite a bit in terms of going out to your community to do that. And do you have many women who come in who are without husbands, who are with no support system there? Talk about that. I see you smiling, which suggests that this is not an unusual circumstance, is it?
No. Unfortunately, a lot of our patients come in for their pregnancy care. They don't have any support or relatively fewer supports. One of the projects we've worked on is actually looking at some of these, I guess you can call them fragile families, mm-hmm. where the woman is on her own and the father may or may not necessarily be part of the scene, mm-hmm. And looking at ways that we can manage to ensure that she's taking care of herself, taking care of the baby properly, and if he wants to be involved, to at least promote some involvement. I'm not saying everyone has to run down to the justice of the peace, mm-hmm. just be involved with mm-hmm. the results of the pregnancy.
I noticed that you've done some cooperative work or collaboration with the social workers over at the School of Social Administration at Temple, where they've been trying to deal with the young adolescent males and to try to work that. How does that work out? Does that have any effect on what you do?
Well, we'd like to think that it has a positive effect mm-hmm. on what we do, because certainly if mom is supported and she has some support in terms of taking care of herself with the pregnancy and she has assistance in terms of taking care of the baby, she has more time to take care of herself. She has more time to take appropriate care of the baby. And ultimately, we would hope that unless she wanted to come back in for baby number two or three or four, that
she would have learned something from baby number one.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And especially if you're talking about the possibility of this resulting in preterm labor.
Yes.
Yes. Incidentally, as we were talking about different kinds of activities, you were also involved in something related to voice recognition system when monitoring pregnant women. What's that about, too? It says with gestational diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded very avant-garde as far as some of the techniques there. Can you tell me what that is?
Well, this is sort of a very interesting marriage, I guess you can call it, a marriage of the use of the Internet, which, of course, 10, 15 years ago, how many of us even had a computer in our home, let alone had Internet access, and medicine. We know from other experiences in medicine that you can actually have communication back and forth between the patient and the healthcare provider online. So we can actually look online, see someone's information, get their information, and via the Internet communicate back with them saying, well, maybe it would be advisable to increase your dose of medication. Maybe we can try to, you know, use another modality. Part of what I'm doing is actually looking and seeing if we can do this with patients with diabetes and pregnancy.
Hmm. Well, what would voice recognition have to do with that? I'm kind of curious. Does it change because of certain conditions?
We're just using it online with the Internet. Optimally, we'd like to be able to bring it to, everyone uses their cell phones and everything else for for communication. I use my cell all the time. But right now, let's start first with the Internet and then work to the wireless.
Well, you've certainly been involved in doing a lot of different collaborative things. And I've seen that you've done a lot of papers and presentations and collaborative efforts with other schools. Now, the effect of, related to morphine, I picked up some of these because I was interested in what you said. Collaboration with the Department of Anesthesiology
mm-hmm.
in an elective cesarean section patients. Because we haven't, it takes me then to the whole notion of cesarean sections. Now, you may share, I'm sure most of our audience knows, but share what a cesarean section would be and how this would come into play in any preterm prospect there. What happens there?
Well, with the cesarean section, that's basically delivery, but not by the vaginal route, not by natural route, but surgically.
Mm.
That paper is looking at a lot of different immune modalities that occur with use of any kind of medications. Not saying that medications are bad, but they're good and warranted, but we see that there's some other effects aside from pain control associated with them. But getting back to the issue with prematurity, depending on the point in the pregnancy, depending on which way the baby is at the time that the delivery is required, we may not have a choice but perform a cesarean section. When we're delivering at term, more than 95% of the babies are head first, what we call vertex, or head down. But earlier in the pregnancy, that baby has lots of space, can roll around and do all sorts of maneuverings that he or she may want to do and may not.
They're active. He can want to do.
they're not sitting still, and their head is not necessarily the first part that's coming into the birth canal. In fact, the incidence of what we call malpresentation, or the baby coming anyway but head first, mm-hmm. is much higher earlier in the pregnancy. And we no longer deliver most breaches vaginally unless they're very premature. So we may end up having to perform a cesarean section, not necessarily for mom not having labor, but more so because it's safer for the baby. Now, when we start talking about very premature, we're 24 weeks. You know, I think all of us have heard of the miracle baby that was born at 24 weeks and graduated from the intensive care nursery and is doing well. That's the miracle. What normally happens with 24-weekers, those have such a hard way to go. Those babies are really not ready yet. Their lungs aren't ready. Their nervous system isn't ready. Their gut's not ready. For some of the really early ones, the skin is, you can almost see through it.
24 weeks is what, 6 months?
Well, we think in terms of weeks. I can't think in terms of months anymore. Okay. So that's 24 weeks after the last cycle. Those babies have a very, very long way to go. And most of those babies are just too fragile to be able to survive.
Would some of them be affected, we haven't talked about this, as you talked about drug involvement, but what about substance abuse, those who have had alcohol and cocaine and all that? Does that affect a lot of the prematurity?
Anything that mom does during a pregnancy can affect the baby, and unfortunately one drug that is rampant, cocaine or any of the cocaine-type drugs, can put a woman into labor. Mm-hmm. It also caused the placenta to start to come off, the afterbirth to come off while the baby's still inside, which is certainly a very dangerous condition for mom as well as for the baby, what we call placental abruption, which mm-hmm. basically means the mm-hmm. placenta's coming off while baby's in. And that puts mom and baby at a very, very serious situation where we may have no other choice but to deliver.
Now, talking about preterm as such, you mentioned to me that you have a personal interest in preterm. Talk about that.
Yes, I do. It's one thing to necessarily talk to patients about preterm delivery, but this is one of those circumstances where you don't know what it's like to be there until you're really there. And since our last interview, I've been kind of busy, and I have a little 6-year-old daughter at home. Mm-hmm. And my pregnancy was going perfectly fine until one day when I was about 32 weeks. I was driving up to work, and it's like, wait a minute, what's this that I'm feeling? And we always tell our patients, if you even think something's wrong, come and give us a call. Well, I sort of made a U-turn, and well, not really a U-turn. I drove back over to my doctor's office and was contracting every 5 minutes. Wow. So, and that was at 32 weeks. Thankfully, things were able to be stopped, and thank God we were able to deliver at term. But that little episode of preterm labor and being treated for it definitely was an eye-opener in terms of what my patients are experiencing. So not that I wasn't empathic before. I try to think that I always had a certain amount of empathy towards the patients, but after going through it firsthand.
You knew the fear involved in this. Mm-hmm. But now, a preterm labor can be stopped?
If it's preterm contractions. Now, this is something that if anyone who practices maternal fetal medicine or perinatology is out in the listening audience, they may or may not necessarily agree. It's one of those circumstances where there might be 3 or 4 ideas about a certain condition. We can slow down preterm labor. We can at least slow down the progress of labor long enough to give mom some medications to get the baby's lungs to mature. That's a steroid that we actually give that would help advance the lung maturity for the baby. It's not the kind of steroids that we're talking about with our athletes that aren't supposed to be taking that. This is a different type of a steroid. Mm-hmm. In terms of if it's going to stop preterm labor and always lead to a nice bundle of joy at 38 weeks, that's one of those circumstances where you may get 3 or 4 different opinions.
Mm-hmm. But there are different modalities. It may be with some patients, I understand that they put the bed rest and all those kinds of different things to try to. But that's one possibility. But the probability is most of them, you don't have that ability to slow it down, do you?
Well, actually, it's at 50-50.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's something that one needs to know, not be so fearful of it, as bad as it might be. You made it, and you stayed on through. And I've just seen the picture of your 6-year-old. So it means we haven't talked for almost 7 years since the last time
yes.
we talked together. And I'm delighted to see you back to talk about all of this. If you had one thing that you want to say to women who may be listening out there, what would you recommend as the most effective way of preventing putting themselves into a condition of preterm delivery?
Well, the first thing I would recommend for all other women out there, for all women out there, who are, even if you're not thinking of being pregnant, is to take care of yourself. You know, we take on roles of the household provider, the household matriarch, which of course takes on how many different roles in terms of taking care of the house, taking care of the kids, taking care of whoever else happens to be there. We oftentimes, myself included, I have to remind myself, can forget to take care of ourselves.
So it's kind of important to remember that we may multitask all we want to, but if that task doesn't include ourselves, we may not be around.
You got that right.
Or do great damage.
Exactly. Who's going to take care of the caregiver?
Yes.
And we have to take care of ourselves. So my first message out to any woman listening to this is that Superwoman is really in the cartoons. And I don't know too many of us that look good in blue tights and a red cape and a big red ass, myself included.
Well, we hope that some of these new modalities that are coming aboard, maybe even this new bioprobe device and some of the others may allow for a better intervention at times of preterm. But if we can prevent it, all the most.
Absolutely.
It's better.
As my grandmother used to say, an ounce of prevention is worth, well, 7 or 8 pounds of cure.
Well, I thank you so much, Dr. Valerie Whiteman, perinatologist at Temple University Hospital. Thank you for being my guest on
University
Forum.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4374.